Welcome to this podcast for Classical 91.5. I'm Julia Figueres. Once again, your Rochester Philharmonic Orchestra will be performing that great cornerstone of holiday programming, Handel's Messiah. This year, we'll hear a version unlike any others we've ever witnessed. We welcome guest conductor Christopher Warren Green and Rochester Oratorio Society Artistic Director Eric Townell, who have come to our studios to talk about it. Hello, Christopher. Welcome.
Hello. Thank you.
And welcome back to our studios, Eric.
Thank you so much, Julia.
So let's talk about this one piece of music which actually premiered in the Lenten season in April of 1742. How did this become such a cornerstone of Christmas music?
Well, it's really more of an Easter piece, I have to say. But you mentioned the first performance, which I actually believe was in Fishamble Street in Dublin, in more or less a theatre. The reason it's still there, in fact, and the reason they know it was there is because they can still find peanut cases on the floor, which was the sort of snack you got when you went to the theatre in Ireland. But there's a marvellous quote from this, because it is, in my opinion, probably one of the greatest ever pieces of music written. There's a marvellous quote from Lord Kinnule in Dublin after the first performance, who went up to Handel and said, "Most wonderful entertainment, Mr. Handel." And Handel turned around and said, "Entertainment, my lord? I should be sorry if that's all it was. I wished to make them better." Now, he's a very spiritual man, Handel, and of course he did a lot of unbelievable things, really, for the time, and not just in music, but in his own personal life.
So at some point this got co-opted from the Easter season, because we never see or rarely hear of Easter performances of Messiah, but here we are rolling into the holiday season, and somehow, Eric, Christmas won.
Well, the Handel and Haydn Society was the first organization to perform it in the U.S., and they more or less set the pattern for Messiah performances down the years. And Oratorio Society, it was the first piece that Oratorio Society performed in 1945 when they were formed.
But this one is very different. Our orchestra, very small, about 27 pieces. We'll have a theorbo player, which is outstanding. A very different version that we're going to hear this time.
Well, different, and yes, I suppose it is. What I tend to do is the Foundling Hospital version, but then over the years I've tended to add the odd thing because I can't be without it. The theorbo is a bit naughty because what it is a bass lute. And we have a fantastic theorbist who I worked with a lot. And he also plays Baroque guitar. I have to say it's more in the Italian Baroque that the theorbo is used than in the English Baroque, but it still is a powerful addition to the Messiah Orchestra. And basically the size of the orchestra is a Baroque size orchestra, but Rochester Philharmonic play on modern instruments. Now, you need a really good orchestra, which you have here, to be able to play in a Baroque style with the kind of oomph and power that those instruments had, although it be decibels lower on modern instruments. It's harder to get the effects on modern instruments, but when you do get them, it's incredibly powerful. And the theorbo actually is louder than a harpsichord. So, you know, people often think when I ask for a theorbo, I say, oh, he's going to do Tafel music. Well, it's not really that at all. I mean, Handel was a dramatic composer above all else.
When you talk about the Foundling Hospital version, what does that mean?
Well, the Foundling Hospital, if you're ever in London, is still there in Bloomsbury. You can walk down the same corridors that Handel walked with, actually, Thomas Coram, who was a ship's captain. And he and, I think it's Hogarth, and I've probably got that wrong, but three of them, it was a triumvirate, who set up a foundation for mothers who found their husbands put in, or their menfolk put in prison. They could bring their children, who they could no longer feed, because that was part of the prison sentence, and leave them on the steps of the Foundling Hospital, and they would be taken care of. And there are stories of, you know, well, I won't go into all those stories because we probably don't have time, but this was at a time when this sort of charitable thing didn't really happen. And just to put that in another light, he also cast for the Messiah, not opera singers. I cast opera singers, not oratorio singers, but opera singers. He cast actors because that sense of drama. Remember, he was very involved in the Italian Opera House in London, which is now the Royal Opera House, Covent Garden. He cast actors at a time when they weren't even buried in consecrated ground. And in fact, there was a member of the clergy who, at that first performance I mentioned earlier in Dublin, who congratulated the alto on her performance as after she'd sung He Was Despised. And he actually said, "For this woman, all your sins can be forgiven," which I think terribly pompous. But there you are. That's what it happened. I don't use a contralto, by the way. I use a countertenor.
Which is another difference, that you're using a countertenor instead of the typical contralto. What is the difference between an opera singer and an oratorio singer?
Well, it's a sound of voice. Eric will tell you more about that, I'm sure.
Well, and the ranges are slightly different. You know, for instance, the original bass aria that Handel wrote for The Refiner's Fire and everything, you know, if we look at it this time, I would cast that as a baritone, but he calls it a bass aria. But, you know, for an oratorio singer, I would use a lighter voice and a baritone for that, because the low notes don't happen to exist.
You might need to cut that. It's not Refiner's Fire.
That's right, and it's not Refiner's. The version is not the same as we.
Sorry, it's an alto. You're talking about bass baritone for Refiner's Fire. I've messed your broadcast up.
No,
I just didn't want to.
The alternate version, the first one, the.
Oh, I see. Okay, starting again. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. So in the very first version, he had a bass aria in there, and I was just looking at it a little bit ago, and it goes up to an F, which I would never cast a bass for. I would, you know, it lies above the staff, and so I would put a baritone in that role.
Yeah, and of course I have an alto singing, which is also another Handel version. And Handel did so many different versions of the piece. And in fact, you know, Mozart has orchestrated the piece. Handel only wrote woodwind parts for one number. I forget which one now, but we have woodwind parts in the whole piece. But going back to the alto, a countertenor, there are some countertenors who actually frankly sound like mezzo-sopranos or contraltos. And that's not desirable. You want a countertenor that sounds like a male singer. Is a color to the voice and a drama to the voice, again, that I like. There are some numbers in The Messiah that actually are more suited to a castrati, and I cut those out because a countertenor simply doesn't sound right in those numbers. But it's all a matter of taste. The point is, as Eric was alluding to, the bass baritone aria, you could pick and choose whatever you want to do. So that was a very long way of answering your question about which version we're doing. There's no set version as such.
Now, there is a new chorus. The Rochester Oratorio Society has sung this any number of times, Eric, and there's a new chorus, one you have never done before.
That's right. It's so good to get some of the choruses that we rarely hear, and their sound has gone out is one that audiences won't have heard in Rochester for many, many years, and possibly the Oratorio Society has done it in their past. So we're delighted to have that opportunity. We actually have 18 choruses to sing for this performance, which is the most we've ever done.
So how do you break your chorus of old habits? Because this chorus is used to singing the Messiah in a certain way and in a certain set of music. You're going to have to break a lot of habits for this performance.
Well, you know, fortunately, we have a very good example in Christopher's. He can emulate the sound he wants. He's very clear about his pronunciations. He sent us very well-defined markings that we've incorporated to the best of our ability. We had a good amount of time to get it into our bodies the right way. And some of them are familiar from previous performances, and we started working on the version we're using for this performance 10 years ago, when we switched from an old G. Schirmer score that had a lot of built-in errors and stylistic inaccuracies that we had kind of typically done it like many American choruses for year and year after year, and just playing wrong notes in it. And so the issue was to start that process a decade ago, and we've had good support from the guest conductors and from Maestro Seaman, who was here for our first several performances as well.
The other Christopher Warren Green, you have obviously worked on Messiah for a long time, and this is something that you have been refining as you go along. Can you remember your first Messiah performance, and how different is it from the one that we are going to be witnessing over the next couple of nights?
Oh, well, my first performance, really. I mean, I became a musician because I started singing in a church choir at 7, and sadly, in England, a lot of those church choirs have disappeared now. The cathedral choirs are still there, choir schools, and the English tradition for choirs is not what it was. It's very sad, because I have to tell all parents that the most important thing you can do is get your child into a choir, and as soon as possible, because it's the fastest way into music, and if you're studying the arts alongside the sciences, it's been proven time and time again that people do better across the board at all subjects. If there's, I bet if you had a pound or a dollar for every time an artist has sat in this studio opposite you and told you that, you know, I mean, it's been proven. But when there's a recession, the first thing they do is cut the arts. Although I would say that after the Second World War, when they went to Churchill and said, oh, Mr. Churchill, there's not much money. Should we cut the arts? And Churchill pounded the desk and said, cut the arts? Why do you think we fought the war? So he was a pretty enlightened person. So, you know, which frankly I don't find amongst many politicians. But that's what that is the power of music. So that was my introduction to the world. And of course the Messiah stuck with me then. So when I first started to conduct it, of course I knew it inside out before I even opened the score. I think there's more to it than that. I think it's such an iconic work. It's difficult really to describe. I've been through all sorts of, in a 42-year career, different traditions as well. I would never turn my back on the Mozart arrangement of the Messiah, or the huge Victorian versions, like in the Royal Albert Hall, when you get to use the organ there, which has got a 64-foot pedal stop that can vibrate even the Royal Albert Hall, to a small version, which can be equally powerful. And that is what we're doing with the Rochester Philharmonic and the Oratorio Singers. It's a very powerful version. It's certainly not a scaled-down, authentic instrument sounding, but certainly, well, I say that, it does sound authentic instrument, but it's on modern instruments.
You talk about Baroque.
You have to come to the concert, you see, otherwise
yes.
I can't really explain it. You just got to rock up.
Well, I will be at the concert. And
not
very,
you,
very...
I'm talking to all the people listening. I know you're going to be there.
So when we talk about the Baroque style, how does one define a Baroque playing versus modern playing? When you talk about Christopher playing a Baroque style on a modern instrument, what will that entail?
Well, style, it just means a choice of expression, actually. But what happened many years back, and a lot of American musicians now have all studied the Baroque instruments and the Baroque styles, from the treatises of Quantz, of Leopold Mozart, of all these composers of the day. People forget that during the Baroque, musicians were very, very good. In fact, all musicians were composers as well. And that's why when Bach started writing out his ornamentation, they were all insulted until Buxtehude, his teacher, just told them all to shut up because he was better at it than they were. But, I mean, I'm dead against a lot of ornamentation, I have to say, because I think someone like Handel knew what he was doing with the harmonies, and over-ornamentation for the sake of it, it just wrecks it. But the whole style thing changed dramatically. Actually, back in, really with Thurston Dart, the harpsichordist, with Neville Marriner and the Academy of St. Martin's, of which I was a member and concertmaster at one time, that spearheaded it. But then what happened is people started to play on the original instruments, or copies of original instruments. And they read the treatise of Quantz, brings me back to the composers of the day, who very specified very clearly in those treatises how to compose and how to read the music. For instance, in modern days, if someone hasn't studied that side of things, a player might often say, well, there's no dynamic in the part, I don't know, what do I do, you know? But actually, the way the music was written is dictated by the intervals, the harmonies, the keys, and also the instruction to like a largo, for instance, in the Baroque times was not a slow tempo. I could go on for hours and bore your audience to death with this, but I mean, that's basically how we've approached it this week with the Rochester Philharmonic, and they've been incredibly fast, as has the chorus, at doing exactly that, just, you know, sort of making it up as you go along, but with a set of rules attached, which are, of course, meant to be broken, as all rules are.
So the chorus in the original Messiah was smaller, and the notes for this concert that Christopher Warren Green did in Minnesota called for a 40-person chorus. Mm-hmm. Your chorus is a little bigger than that.
Yeah, it's more like 140.
Exactly.
And what's more, I really have a lot of women in this chorus, and Handel wouldn't have heard it that way either. So it's been, and he would have heard it at a lower pitch than we're performing, I believe, in the Foundling Hospital for certain. And so there are challenges when you have adult sopranos, for instance, singing parts that are intended for boys. And then you have interior parts that were sung by just changed voices or by young male voices that have a certain clarity and a certain incisiveness that we have to really work hard to achieve when you have adult voices singing them. So it's been a special challenge, and but, you know, everything starts with the text for the chorus. And so, for instance, in His yoke is easy and His burthen is light. When you sing the chord for light, there is a color to that that says the meaning of the word. And as long as that's your guiding principle and you can get choristers enlisted to that idea that they're really trying to express through the color of the vowel the sense of the text, all of a sudden it's a magical and a fun chase to try to accomplish.
This has been a piece of music that is absolutely beloved, mm-hmm. I mean, from the get-go. So what is it about? And you, Maestro Warren Green, have clearly stated that it is one of the greatest, if not the greatest, work. Why? What is it about this piece that pierces the heart so perfectly?
It's a million-dollar question, isn't it? It's like, why do people like Carmine Burana, which actually pales into insignificance compared to the Messiah? Beethoven was completely influenced by Handel. I think a lot of it is to do with the text, you know, the nativity, the prophecy, all these things. And even if you're not a religious person, overtly in any way, the words somehow mean something. And I agree with Eric, that I base my interpretation on the text, on making the audience believe everything that's sung. The tunes, the harmonies, I mean, they've just, you know, stood the test of time. That's all I can really say. It's also an extraordinary piece of music in that he did things he'd never done before. For instance, the opening overture finishes in E minor, and he then goes straight into Comfort Ye in E major. The prophecy suddenly comes from heaven, whereas with every other oratorio he'd ever written, he started with a minuet or a jig after the overture. But he changed it for the Messiah. And it's interesting that Jennens, the librettist, just thought he'd made a terrible job of it, thought that Handel had made a terrible job of it. And which, you know, clearly he had not. The sad thing is that we rarely get to do the full version of the Messiah, which is over 3 hours long. I believe it's, yeah, it does. Well, it certainly runs over 2.5 hours. But there again, Handel himself didn't always do the full version. But how do you define what is a great masterpiece? It can only be standing the test of time. That's what makes it a real classic, I believe. Not even in its immediacy. I mean, there was a lot of great music was written. Look at the Rite of Spring, the riot that you know, broke out with Ravel hitting somebody over his top hat with his cane. You know, literally a fight in the audience. I mean, who would have known that would become one of the most iconic works of the last century? So I can't answer it other than that. It's a test of time.
What did Mozart do to it when he?
Oh, he did some wonderful things. I mean, he put trombones in the most, I mean, luscious, luscious texts you couldn't believe. And actually, a contemporary of mine, a very good friend of mine, Andrew Davis, Sir Andrew Davis, he's orchestrated. He's got marimbas and xylophones in there and all sorts of stuff, you know. Huge versions that can be done. And Mozart's version certainly can't be taken away. But that's what I'm saying, is that Handel didn't write the whole orchestration. The wind parts that we mostly play are from the Watkins Shaw edition were not written by Handel. So, but the music was most definitely written by Handel. So you can't argue as to which orchestration you should do. We're doing more or less the closest to the orchestration that Handel would have done.
Eric, when did this thing turn into such a monster? When did it turn into this huge pageantry?
Victorians, surely.
Yeah. And certainly in our country, Leonard Bernstein had a lot to do with that. And there are performances where the choruses have all been orchestrated out. And I have an LP of that where the chorus doesn't sing at all. It's all written into the orchestra.
Fascinating. I didn't know any of that.
And it's surprisingly effective. I mean, you just can't ruin it. It's wonderful music and exciting in all of its incarnations, it seems.
Should we make this the slogan? Handel's Messiah, you just can't ruin it.
Well, there's a Bernstein anniversary coming up. You should do one of his versions.
It's a great idea.
You have got two concerts right in a row. Mm-hmm. These are not, many of your singers are not professional singers. Mm-hmm. And that's a lot of work to sing these two concerts. So what kind of voice-saving techniques are you working with them on?
Well, the good part about it is Handel is remarkably grateful to sing if you're vocally healthy and if you use your breath accurately and well. And the challenge for a singer is mostly to rely on the large muscles to get the work done rather than do everything, with the small muscles and try to articulate all the fast notes, for instance, with little H's. And, Meister Green said last night, we don't want to hear, but make the sense of the line flow in the shape that Handel gave it and give it the proper amount of air, and off we go. And so fortunately, we were able to use some of the Messiah choruses in our most recent performance. And so in terms of the learning curve, our members have been very comfortable with it so far. And we're grateful to them for their dedication of time and effort.
How was the chorus when you got to meet them for the first time, Christopher?
Furious. I was late. I flew in from London, England, and for some reason, a certain airline wouldn't let me on the flight. I've never been refused before. And it was something to do with visa changes or something. I was coming in through another country instead of straight through. So luckily I managed to switch flights and then fly in through New York and get to Rochester, and was picked up and driven straight to the chorus rehearsal and confronted with the chorus sitting there in silence, 3/4 of an hour late. And all you budding conductors out there, learn this lesson now. Even after 42 years, you never keep an orchestra or a chorus waiting. However, in this modern age, what do you do if someone will not let you get on a flight, terribly difficult. You can't come 3 weeks before. That's what happens. But they were absolutely charming. And I jest, of course. As we started to rehearse, the first thing that became very apparent, and this is not supererogation, and I don't say it because he's sitting beside me, but it was very clear that the amount of time we spent on the telephone, Eric and I, he had trained the chorus in exactly what I needed to do, what he knew my interpretation was going to be. So there was very little left for me to do. And it is very rare that a chorus director makes that takes that much trouble. So I thank him for that. And it was very rewarding because everybody was really wanting to enjoy it. And we went straight through for over 2 hours without a break. The chorus was still fine. I was dead on my feet. But the walking wounded, in fact.
Well, that was a great experience. Very fun experience. And it's made it so enjoyable for us all. So it's just been a joy.
Well, it's really, I think, an honor and a treat for all of us in Rochester to have Christopher Warren Green coming in to do Messiah. When I saw this on the schedule when it was first released, I became kind of a crazy woman. Honey, you're not going to believe this. This is awesome.
Yeah, it is awesome.
So what is this your dream, sort of, if you were allowed all the money and all the time in the world, Christopher, would it be to do the whole thing in straight traditional early style?
Not necessarily, no, not necessarily. As I said before, Handel was a dramatic composer. He was larger than life. All this work he did for charity and, as I said, casting, actors when they weren't even buried in consecrated ground. He once held a soprano out of a first floor window by her ankles because she wouldn't sing the way he wanted her to. Excuse me. Remarkable man, really. I'd like to have known him. I often say to sopranos, tell them that story, and then I say, so now there is only one possibility, if they're not going to cooperate with me. But he also snatched once Corelli, who was the foremost concertmaster composer in Italy at the time. Of course, you have to remember there are four styles of Baroque: Italian, French, German, English, and Corelli being the master of the Italian Baroque, but he came over to lead Handel's orchestra in London. And he was getting it wrong, and Handel snatched the violin from him and said, "Not like that, you fool, like this." And Corelli didn't rise to it in any way, just said, "Well, maestro, if I only did but understand the English style," brings us back to the word style, you know, in the Baroque. It's a subject we could spend hours on, of course. But he's a fascinating man. But I don't, for me, yes, I do like to try and get very as close as you can to the way the instruments would have sounded at the time, when I speak about the Baroque style. But it's the sense of drama that I'm after in Handel. And the belief that when they sing, especially the soloists, that they can make anyone in the audience, especially a child who's never heard the piece before, believe and listen, which is why we spoke so much about diction and text. That's the most important thing for me. And sheer beauty. I mean, that's, you know, any composer is actually in the hands. Even Mozart, Bach, Handel, any composer is in the hands of the interpreter. And you can really foul up. You really can. So it's a responsible job that we have. And as a conductor, you have to be an enabler. You have a lot of very fine musicians in front of you, and singers, and you have to enable them to give of their best and hopefully inspire them. So I can't say any more than that, really. There's no sort of secret mystery except being, you know, a real musician. I would add, again, if there are any young conductors listening, study the Baroque. You're all hell-bent on conducting the Rite of Spring. The Rite of Spring's not difficult. It's not difficult to conduct. It's supposed to be the most difficult piece to conduct. It's not. You learn it, you conduct it. It's simpler, you know. But the Baroque, if you understand the Baroque and you can interpret it, you can interpret any piece of music that's been written ever since. So often you can see a conductor, a young conductor, not necessarily all young conductors, but maybe an experienced, struggling, especially with Beethoven. And if you understand the Baroque, you will be able to understand Beethoven. You will be able to interpret it, phrase it, and that's the most important thing, again.
And should we all stand when the Hallelujah Chorus begins?
Do you know, I did it very recently for the first time in London, and they didn't stand.
Oh.
Whenever I do it in America, they always stand for the Hallelujah Chorus. And I'm sure you know the story.
Go ahead and say it again.
Well, I know you might have another slant on it, but they say that the king stood up on the opening rousing bars of the Hallelujah Chorus. But there are two theories that actually it wasn't the rousing music that made him stand up. It was actually the fact that he'd fallen asleep and woke up and stood up. So they all had to stand up, and then a sort of egg on the face. Everyone had to remain standing. Well, I'm sure it's true. I've actually had an interesting story to tell you. The Prince of Wales asked me to put together a Handelian orchestra for his mother's 80th birthday, which he held in Kew Palace, which is a little Georgian doll's house type palace, which George III built. The idiot who lost America. George III's wife, Queen Charlotte, which is the city where I'm music director, was named. The Prince of Wales asked me to put this Handelian orchestra together to play, you know, as a little concert just for the royal family alone before he had dinner with his mother in that palace. And he'd found what he thought was George III's harpsichord in the royal collection, somewhere in the basement or something. Well, anyway, we dug it out, and I then found out that it was actually Frederick, Prince of Wales's harpsichord, but we didn't bother too much about the details. Handel would have played it either way, you know. So we had this harpsichord, fantastic, and I rock up with my musicians, the London Chamber Orchestra, and they're fantastic players. And the harpsichord's been detensioned, so it's not only a semitone low, but you'd never be able to tune it up to concert pitch. You'd break it, because the entire thing had been put back to be played with authentic instruments or original instruments. So we're now thinking, what am I going to do? I've got the entire royal family. The Queen's going to come in and stand right by my shoulder, which she did. But my harpsichord is, bless her heart, because I spoke to the oboes, and they said, well, you know, we really can't get down that low. It's not going to happen. We can't do it. She transposed the entire evening up a semitone. Oh. whilst improvising, obviously, the continuo part, which I thought was a spectacular thing. But the interesting thing was that actually to have Handel's harpsichord, if you like, or rather Frederick Prince of Wales harpsichord, an instrument that Handel would have played, and play his music in Kew Palace, it was wonderful. I just thought I'd share that. There was a little bit of information, probably not interesting to anybody.
No, I think that Eric and I both want to know what it feels like to have the Queen standing over your shoulder.
She's quite something. She's a wonderful, wonderful person. She really is. But the orchestra was sort of, you know, eyebrows making faces. I said, what's the matter with him? And so I said, why are they making... And then I looked, and there she was. So we finished the number we were playing. And she was thrilled. She'd been walking around Windsor all day long on her 80th birthday, you know, shaking hands with the crowds and all the rest of it, and this was the evening. It was a great thing to be able to do, especially with Handel. We're lucky because the Prince of Wales is a great music lover, as is the Duchess of Cornwall, and she's the patron of my orchestra in London, so that does help enormously in being able to keep orchestras alive.
Wow. The Queen is your patron?
No, Camilla, the Duchess of Cornwall, is a patron of my orchestra. But I've been conducting for the Prince of Wales since 1980. He invited me to conduct the first concert in Buckingham Palace well, it's the ballroom, really, but it's where the thrones are, in modern times, which means probably since Johann Strauss the First conducted for Queen Victoria. She loved waltzing. She waltzed all around the ballroom to Johann Strauss the Father's orchestra.
I can't imagine playing for royalty. I can't.
Well, it's a big thrill. It's a big thrill, especially if you're a monarchist. If you're not a monarchist or a royalist, actually, funnily enough, I've seen many people disarmed. People who just poo-poo it and say, well, I don't know, why would you bother with them? But they're completely disarmed when they actually meet them in a room. And they do a great job for our country. They really do.
I want to thank you very much for coming in and spending time with us. And allowing us to be in the presence of he who has had the Queen hover over his shoulder.
Never mind that. What about Handel's harpsichord?
This is not unlike somebody who's playing a Stradivarius or an Amati, with all the history of all those fingers that have touched that and harpsichord is wood. So that energy must have been absorbed at some point. So Handel is still in that room. He's still in that building forever. I want to thank you both for coming in and spending time with us to talk about Messiah. The Messiah concerts, of course, are with the RPO. And if you are interested in attending this concert or anything more about the RPO, you can go to rpo.org. Christopher Warren Green and Eric Tonell were my guests. I'm Julia Figueres. This podcast is a production of WXXI Public Broadcasting.